Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very, very special episode of MTG Potpourri. You know how special it is, Conley?
It's so special that the person who would normally coin it special is not here, and you had to say it anyway?
That's right. It's so special, Tom couldn't take it. Punked out. Just walked. He's like, it's too special. Can't handle it.
He has some cat's hearts to fix or something like that.
Yeah, I guess, like, the school bus of kittens, you know, how, like, the kittens all go to school. Like, the school bus of kittens got hit by, like, the dog bus. So, like, just lots of puppies and kittens everywhere that need help. So, Super Vet Tom is taking care of lives, which just leaves two men without them to talk about magical things.
Whoa. I resent that. If we don't have lives, then how come we can't put out a regular podcast, huh? That's all I'm saying.
I'm Adam Staworski. That's Conley Woods.
You're going to leave me hanging? You're just going to leave me hanging like that?
All right. We're here to talk about magical things. And so we don't have Tom thrill us with amazing B-movie discussions or highly explicit, very uncomfortable animal sexuality topics.
I enjoy both those things from time to time, though.
Yeah, a little bit. So, so if you only tune in to see how insane we'll let Tom be, I hate to disappoint you. You'll have to make do with just us.
We could, like, edit in some Tom quotes at the end, just, like, insert random places, just so everyone feels like he's here.
Well, I mean, that's what's so dangerous about this, is that because Tom is still going to do the editing for us, because Tom's amazing like that, he can splice in whatever he wants. So, Tom, if you're listening to this, use your powers wisely. Please, please make sure you splice in something funny and awesome, and not just make us look like buffoons.
Yeah, or both.
But it's a good thing only one of us is an idiot, and I'll definitely give that that's me. So, we have a new set coming out, right, Conley?
Well, the pre-release has already happened, and so I guess the release is this coming weekend. Well, I assume this is going up before the weekend, but maybe not. But yeah, it Cons of Tarkir. I'm all ready for the Pro Tour. I'm going deep into the tank for Standard, trying to break the format, but we'll see if I get there or not.
And it's one of those sets where I think people are really excited for the limited side too. You know, so there's a lot of big benefits for Cons coming in for Standard. I know from talking at one of the last at the Grand Prix Salt Lake City, a lot of the pros were like, you know, yeah, I love his Revelation and that those type of decks, but also it's kind of nice to have, you know, the Supreme Verdict since his Revelation duo kind of go out of Standard too. So I you know,
and
it's just like things are
and Detention Sphere, don't forget that one,
and Detention Sphere and Azorius Charm and all the value that you can handle.
Literally absurd.
Yeah, so Standard's going to get a big shakeup. That's a little premature, I think, especially for you, Conley. I know you don't want to show any of your hand heading to the Pro Tour, but I think for Limited, it's a ripe topic, and I think we can easily talk about some of our experiences at the pre-release and maybe get a little insight into where things are going to go with Morph and five new mechanics that we've got to figure out.
Sure.
So do you want to talk about your pre-release first, Conley? Or?
Sure. It was very slim. It was only one flight of one day, so four rounds, so I didn't get to stick around and play any more than that. But, I mean, in Sealed, Morph, I would say, is actually... It's prevalent in that you want the Morph creatures because some of them are very good, but it's not as prevalent in that you need them to necessarily make out your deck, because you tend to have a ton of fixing and sealed inherently, because you don't have to use any picks on it, and therefore you just have it. And building a very solid two-color splash third or three-color, maybe three-color splash fourth deck is, like, very easy, so the need for colorless creatures is not as high in sealed, I would say, although the desire to play them is still there, because whenever Morph's in a format, this is the second time, or I guess third time it's been around, the 2/2 for 3 is, like, the go-to trademark of the set. So things that deal 2 damage are very important. Things that trade with morphs when they unmorph are very important. Not trade, but, you know, kill them. Things that that sweep the board. The two toughness, like, is kind of the important go-to. And, like, just a 3-mana 2/3, for example, is, like, going to be extremely strong in this format just because morph exists. Whereas in M15 or whatever, you have Midnight Guard is quite strong because of his ability, but if he was just vanilla or whatever, you might not be as impressed with him. He'll actually be better in this set just because morph is like the standard for everything. But yeah, in sealed, it's, I would say, sticking to as few colors as possible is best if you're newer to the format, because it's pretty risky to go 4 and 5 colors, just because if your deck doesn't work out, you're stuck with a lot of spells in your hand. I don't know how many colors you ended up going, Adam, but I stuck to the main 3 that were in Abzan and or Obzon. I don't know how everyone's pronouncing it yet.
Obzon.
All right, Obzon. But I'm a big Junk fan, and I think the Charm is probably the best. It's my favorite, at least. It's like one of those cards that's even better in Limited than it is in Constructed, because the third mode is even more relevant. Where it puts 2+1/+1 counters on something. That doesn't come up as often in Constructed. But, yeah, my pool was pretty straightforward, guys. I had a couple of the Delve creatures in my deck that, like the 6-mana 4/4 guy, Trample. That guy's just very, very strong, I think, in every deck.
Mandrills!
Yeah, you just cast him for, like, 3 mana, and you just have a giant 2-play. And, it, like, because he's 6 mana, it's not like you need to rush him out there. Like, your guys are just going to trade in combat, and you're just going to cast him on turn 4 because you've lost 2 guys. Like, it's very, very good. And then I had the 3-3 flyer. I'm still learning all the names, but the 6-mana 3-3 flyer. He was also very good. As was to be expected, I would say. Obviously, removal is very important in these types of formats because there's a lot more powerful creatures running around. You have, you know, these really undercosted, you know, 4/4 lifelinkers for 5 when they come out of morph, and, like, that's just something you don't see in a traditional format because it's too good of a rate. Usually people piece that kind of thing together, like, here's an aura on this guy, and now he's a 4/4 lifelinking vigilance or something. But those things just happen in this format because it's multicolor. So having removal to deal with those types of things is very important. Big toughness creatures like the Mastodon, the 2/8, like, that guy's actually very playable because he holds a ton of things back. I think it's a very, very fun format. You basically want to stick to a wedge if you can, or less. And then I would say to explore the 4th and 5th color after you get a little more familiar and comfortable with the format.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with most of that. I had an opportunity to do gunslinging at a local store, so I had the luxury of not having to just fight 4 different opponents. I got to play against probably 14 or 15 different pre-release decks.
Sure.
So I went Obzon because that's my clan. I'm not trying to edge my extra 1% of whatever I can get. But I ended up actually building basically a Mardu deck, splashing green off of a really good fixing. So I had, like, I opened 10 non-basics, and 7 of them were basically on color for the deck that I ended up playing, which worked out really well. It was interesting because as typically, you know, it feels like Mardu wants to be the kind of like the Punisher kind of clan, where it's like, if you're trying to do some really derpy equal stuff, it's just going to kill you with guys before you can do that, to kind of keep things in check. So my deck played a lot slower. It obviously had more of the Outlast guys. But the two things that really stood out to me were, the first was just how important it felt to be the first to be able to attack with a morph and have 5 mana up behind it. Like, just being able to threaten the flip on the block and get the value out of the morph like that, it made me want to be on the play.
So quickly, just to reference, for anybody that doesn't understand what Adam's talking about, there's a new guideline they use for morphs this time, where the amount of mana you have to spend to unmorph something such that the true body that it was will become a new body that will both survive and kill the other morph, so have at least 2 power and at least 3 toughness. You have to at least spend 5 mana on that. So if your opponent ever has less than 5 mana when they attack you with a morph, the worst they can do when they unmorph is trade with your morph. Like, they'll flip into a 3-1 or a 2-1 or a 1-1 death touch or something, but it will never outright kill your morph, so you never have to be afraid of that. But once they have 5 mana available, at that point, then you have to kind of fear that they have a 4-4 under there, or, you know, a 3-4 or something like that, something that will actually kill your morph and live, and then that's a terrible trade for you at that point. Continue.
Yeah. So I wanted to be on the play. That felt like, especially for my deck, because I didn't have a lot of evasion, so I really relied on, as Abzan kind of doesn't have a lot of that. They've got like the ground tank kind of thing going on, so I really needed to get kind of every incremental edge I could on the ground, because I needed to be able to fight through a stalemate. I needed to be able to get my damage in and, you know, have Insulti Scavenger, you know, be the bird that I need to get through.
Which one's that guy?
It's the 3/3 flying with delve for.
Okay, so yeah, I was talking about it earlier.
Yeah, very similar to the mandrels. Just a really solid guy. Like, I can consistently cast him for like 3 or 4 mana. Late in the game, it was great once you get a couple trades in.
Yeah, I think the death touch version of them is also good, but it is 2 more mana, so it's a little bit more hefty.
Yeah. But what I also really struggled with, and this is kind of seems to be like a tension at the core of it, at least on sealed. I think draft is always a different beast with how decks come together. But I wanted to play first because I always wanted to be able to have my morph mana up first and just be able to get that incremental edge going. But at the same time, if my opening hand on the play didn't have mana fixing and I had to mulligan, like, it was just really punishing. Being on the play and relying on comes into play tapped mana, especially after a mulligan or two, because you just lose so much tempo. Like, you're just, you know, you're an extra turn or two behind while you're also down a card or two. And I really struggled to win if I wasn't going first and had good mana. So I don't know if you had any thoughts around that. If people at the store like some of the better players seemed split on it. It was like, you know, some of the guys were like, you know, I want to play first. I want to have my morph mana up. I want to be, you know, I want to be pushing that in as soon as I can. And then the other side was, I want to draw first every single game I can. I want to make sure, you know, my mana that I always hit the mana that I'm looking for, and I can always cast my spells.
I think those are going to be the two camps throughout the format, and I think that's going to be deck-based as opposed to format-based. I basically think that the more aggressive decks will definitely want that 5 mana up, and the more controlling decks would rather be on the draw. Well, not necessarily be on the draw, but they want to have their mana fixed. So I think the times you're going to go on the draw most often are when you have poor mana and you're kind of a deck that relies on some shaky mana costs, let's call them. But if you have really good mana, like in your case, you sounded like you had pretty good mana with all the land you open and stuff, like, you probably could risk the tempo, because the beautiful thing about this format is, sure, casting your ABC cost on turn 3 is significantly easier on the draw because you have an extra shot at another land or whatever. But if you cast your ABC cost, like Anna Fenza or whatever her name is, on turn 3 on the play, it's so much more powerful than on the draw, because if you cast on the play, even if they match it with a 4-4 for 3, which they're not likely to, if you then untap with 3 or 4 mana first, you can charm their guy and get in there for 4, and now you're way ahead. So while it is true that, like, getting your mana out is good, the tempo that you, from on the play, from either unmorphing at 5 mana or casting these gigantically undercosted creatures early, is very good. So I think that if you can afford it, if you have good enough mana, if you have enough lands in your deck, that's one thing you need to make sure. If you don't have good mana, don't skimp on your lands. You can't be running, like, bad mana 15 land decks. That's not a thing. But make sure you have, you know, 17, 18 lands, maybe some banners, depending. And then you just want to go on the play as often as possible and make sure your mana actually is able to do these things. And then in the times where you have the most controlling deck ever with 6 sweepers in it, sure, go on the draw. In the times where your mana is awful and you want to play a control deck because that's what you ended up with, you go on the draw. And I think it's more risky to go on the draw in draft in this format because a good Mardu deck could be put together much easier, and you could just be punished. But at the same time, or a prowess deck for that matter. But at the same time, I would still prefer to go on the play. I think in both formats, I would be more willing to go on the draw in sealed. But like I said, I would just make that the exception. Consider both of them. This is certainly not an all or none type thing. Like, you want to be doing both in this format. It's really, really going to be deck dependent.
So there's a follow-up question I have there. So one of the things that kind of carried over, and a lot of the veteran players, I'll say, that have been around since Shards of Alara era is they just instinctively built 18 land decks. You know, and so the prevailing wisdom that was being distilled or shared with me, whether I want it or not, was, you know, if you're planning on always hitting 5 mana, you know, on the dime, 18 lands is what you want to be playing. Do you think with how important it is to be able to, just to be able to cast, you know, your big 5 drops and 6 drops, to be able to present at least the threat of unmorphing something when you attack, do you feel that 18 lands is really the way to go, or is the 23-17 split kind of?
I think that, again, it's going to be deck dependent. I haven't played the format enough to say as a rule 18 lands. I think that there are certainly some decks that probably should have 18 lands in this format, but oftentimes you're not going to want more than 17 lands. You're going to want to try to fill out your mana sources elsewhere, whether it's through land searching up, like the one that grabs one of each basic. I don't know, I can't remember that. That's a very, I don't know. But it costs 4 mana, grabs one of each basic, except for itself. All the banners, for example. Like, a 17 land deck with 2 banners is, like, you know, has more mana in it than an 18 land deck, for all intents and purposes. So, I don't know. I think 18 lands is fine, especially if you're not sure. Go ahead and go with 18 lands. But at the same time, the spells are so strong, and you're going to end up with quite a few playables. Like, from what I could tell from around the drafts in the room, people had 6-7 cards in their sideboards that could easily have had in their main deck, and it would have been fine. And since you end up with so many playables, the fact that you're cutting a very, very strong spell, theoretically, for another land is actually a big sacrifice. Normally, in, like, a core set draft, you're cutting, like, your weakest bandage card or maybe a giant growth at the best, some, like, that you can afford to get rid of to add an 18th land. But in this format, you're cutting, like, you know, a 3-4 loon flyer that morphs or whatever. Like, that's your, like, worst card. So it is actually a pretty big deal to play 18 lands, so you need to kind of know. But at the same time, like you said, it's almost certainly better if you're uncertain to just play 18 lands, because unmorphing on turn 5 for 5 mana is quite strong. But you don't want to end up with an 18 land 5 banner deck. Don't do that. That's way too much mana. You'll flood out and be very upset.
So looking at your deck, or at least also maybe some of the decks that you played against some of your opponents, what were some of the standout cards that maybe jumped out at you in a way that you didn't necessarily expect when you first saw it?
Well, I had the 3-4 flyer that distributes +1/+1 counters, high sentinels of something or another. And well, I knew that guy was clearly going to be strong. Like, he's a flyer. I didn't realize quite how big he got, how quick he got that big. Like, the guy is like a 5-6 half the time when you cast him for 4 mana, and then you untap, you pump something else up, and he's a 6-7 flyer, and nothing even comes close to killing it. I mean, obviously, removal is supposed to kill it, but, like, nothing, you know. There's not a lot of reach in this format. I don't know if you noticed that. Most of the flying is going to be actual true flying. So, like, that guy just ruled the skies and crushed down, especially in a black-white green strategy, because they have a lot of +1/+1 counter synergies. I got 2 Obzan Charms, whatever. And that card's obviously the nuts, so I was very happy with that. And I had high sentinels with it, and I got to make the charm 2 dudes that don't have counters on them when I had 3 mana up to give him +2/+2. One time, that was pretty sick. But my deck was basically 2 charms, that rare. I had the other rare I had, which is also busted, is the Hydra. I don't know his new name.
Hooded Hydra?
Yeah.
That guy's also. That was Gathering busted. Magic's preview. How did you miss that?
that card. Well, how did I miss that? I know the card's awesome. I just didn't realize quite how strong it was. Like, the morph ability is surprisingly strong. I thought I was just gonna be casting it every time, and 5 mana to make it a 5/5, like, saving that extra 2 mana is actually a very, very big deal. So if you could, like, sneak him in into play on turn 4 and, like, just, like, let him survive for a turn, maybe you have I had the +1/+1, give it protection from a color, put a +1/+1 counter on it card.
Speed of resistance, yeah.
Yeah, so I got to, somebody, at one point, I played turn 3 banner, turn 4 hydromorphed, they went to kill it, I cast that card on it, put a +1/+1 counter on it, and the way +1/+1 counters work is that they stay through morph. So my Hydra next turn unmorphed and was a 6/6 because it gets the 5+1/+1 counters plus the one from this ability, and so I had a 6/6 Hydra that, like, I don't even think he died, but if he did die, like, 6 snakes is obviously fine, or whatever he makes. I don't know what he makes, but those are the two rares I played, so I was pretty lucky in that regard because they're both very, very powerful. But I only played those two rares, and I had a surprisingly lack of mana fixing. I had two tri-lands, neither of which were in my colors, and I did have a bunch of gain life lands, but they were, like, all various, like, you know, green, red, and stuff. I think I only had one or two that were in my colors. So I played, like, one or two fixers that were lands, and then everything else was banners and stuff. I think I had two or three banners. So my mana wasn't terrible, but it was certainly not what I would hope for. That was definitely the weakest part of my pool. But most of the time, I think sealed, you're going to... Like, I had plenty of fixing. I just didn't have plenty of fixing for the colors I wanted to be in, really.
But. Yeah, it sounds like you kind of had, like, a pool very opposite of mine. So I was pretty removal light. So I was very happy to get into Mardu because I could play, like, Burn Away, which is the 5-mana red instant, deal 6, and when that creature dies, exile all cards from its controller's graveyard. I liked it. It felt really good to nail the Delve player before they got the Delve some really dumb stuff. I'm pretty sure I nailed some guy that was trying to set up, like, going on a treasure cruise.
Sure.
Something like that, and he was just like... The look when I said, no, it exiles everything from the graveyard, and he's like, really? Let me see that. Oh, wow. He just looks so sad.
Did you ever have the ability to be relevant against a non-Delve player for any reason? That's why I was looking to see if the card ever did anything against non-Delve players in, like, a meaningful way.
I don't think so. I mean, there's, like, the random Raise Dead type effects.
Yeah,
Bloodsoak Champion. I nailed a Bloodsoak Champion incidentally with it one time. You know, but the two one Bloodsoak Champion actually wasn't that much of a problem by that point in the game. So, I mean, that's why it was there. He spent all of his mana making some fatty instead.
Sure.
I opened a Crackling Doom, which kind of helped push me over into Mardu. Crackling Doom's the 2 damage to each opponent, and then they each sacrifice the creature with greatest power. And it's also an instant, so I got to use it mid-combat when somebody flipped up their morph to eat mine. You know, I could Crackling Doom them in response and make them sack the morph before combat damage, which is a very neat trick to remember.
You can't actually remember. You can't actually respond to an unmorph. That's not a thing you can do. It's kind of dumb that you can't, but it's just the rules and the way it works. Instead, you can respond to, like, any triggers that unmorphing would cause. So, in the case of, like, the guy that says target creature can't block and you unmorph me, you can respond to that trigger. That's the closest you can get to responding to an unmorph. Otherwise, in Adam's scenario he's talking about, you're basically, he's passing priority and saying, can I go to damage after this block or whatever, and you're saying, no, I'm going to kill it. But yeah, morph is a very strange ability in the way that the stack kind of works with it.
The card that actually won me the most games, not close, and you can tell I had a heavy Obzon lead, was Obzon Falconer. And this is the 2/3 for 3 with Outlast, 1 white. So it's actually a very strong card on its own, just playing it on curve, outlasting on the next turn. So 4 mana invested for a... 3/4.
Fire, right? Where it's another creature.
Yeah, and it makes everything with a +1/+1 flying. So 4 mana invested for a 3/4 flying is already all right. Like, doesn't feel that bad. It's like effectively comes into play tapped. So I think like Carrion Crows, but it's just like you take the tap turn the next turn rather than the turn you cast it.
You get to block with it both turns, which is pretty important.
Whenever you outlast, you
okay, yeah, outlast is a sorcery, sorry.
Yeah. I really wish it was instant too. But
I only had like two outlast cards in my deck, and I don't think I drew them very often.
Yeah, but I mean, it just Falconer, like, especially when the opponent didn't know you had one in your deck, you could set up these really weird situations where, like, you play stuff like Disowned Ancestor, Salt Road Patrol, you know, like, Disowned Ancestor is an 0/4 for one black, so it's a great card on turn one if you have the Swampy, you don't need to take a turn off to play a tap land. But it has Outlast one in the black, and so it's just one of those early things where you can quickly get, like, a 2/6 or a 3/7, and it just, like, stalls out even the, you know, even Teemer Fatties. But, like, the Disowned Ancestor, Salt Road Patrol, 2/5 with Outlast, just my random Outlast guys, I could throw a counter on them, and the opponent would kind of crack in, and, you know, it looks like they're ahead on board, and then I would untap, play the Falconer, and suddenly I can crack in for, you know, like, 8 flying in the air, and they're just dead. Numerous times, it was just, I'd set up, you know, some +1/+1 counters, and untap, and they're just dead. Very strong card. Definitely was not what I expected when I got it. One of the other rares I had was Herald of Affinenza. That's the 1/2 for one rare Outlast soldier, where 2 and a white and tap it for Outlast, but you also get a 1/1 warrior. I feel like if you do and you're looking for a way to generate tokens, if you're on like the double trumpet blast type deck, it doesn't feel so bad. But just making 1/1s that could, like, chump the bigger things the opponents are casting, like, 3 mana is, like, the same as putting down a 2/2. And then when you have 5 mana, you can do other stuff with it. So, like, spending 3 mana and tapping, by turn 4 or 5, you know, one of the larger creatures I control just to make a 1/1 behind it, it didn't feel as good as I wanted it to. Like I expected Herald of Affinenza to be able to just take over games. Like, just, wow, I can just make an endless stream of tokens, and at some point, you know, I'll just have, like an 8/9 to crack in with. But the rate, you know, the power of creatures is just so much, like, those tokens don't keep up with the damage that you can be taking.
Sure. Yeah, it costs 3 to activate, too, right, I believe?
Yeah, it's like I could either make a 1/1, make a +1/+1 counter on this and make a 1/1, or I can play my morph. And, like, I feel like playing the morph has always felt stronger. Except when I had, like, nothing else to do, of course. Like, that's when, that was kind of my final verdict on Outlast was, you know, when, I looked at it, it's like, okay, great, I can make these stalemate breakers, I can really pump these guys up. Like I played against a guy who had 2 of the 2/8s. It just, like, stonewalled me so hard. Like, I couldn't even, you know, like, I couldn't even do, like, the attacks where I send in, like, you know, like, 3/3/3s, because he just double blocks one of them and can kill my 3/3, and, like, okay, well, I dealt 6 damage, or, he chumped with something else, or traded with something else. Like, they're just so big, it's, realistically, there isn't any combat trick that can take out that 8 toughness. So, like, it took a lot of turns, like, and eventually I made, like an 8/12 Salt Road Patrol to start fighting with, but the Falconer was what let me just, like, sail right over. Like, even if I couldn't get rid of whatever Fatius were in play, the Falconer got me out of there.
So how did you do your pre-league? Did you win the whole thing?
Well, I was gunslinging, so I wasn't in the main event.
You only got, you didn't do any fights?
Yeah, I didn't do any fights, but basically I played about half the players in the store. at least one game. You know, everybody, you know, apparently when you put a pile of packs next to you and, like, you're the loot pinata, everybody wants to take a swing. So I had you had your Ferocious Icy Blast. Nice job. Like, good game. Like, your super fireball. But I was about 50% in games overall. Like, I looked at, like, I kept track of my score sheet, and I always put a little X on whoever lost, whichever side had lost, and across the whole day I was 50%, which I was pretty happy with. Like, you know, like, if everybody I played against, like, it was effectively a coin flip, you know, I'm okay with that. Like, I know I can improve. It's a small sample size, but I, like, the format feels really rich. Like, there's just a lot of texture with the morphs. And for the first time in a long time, I was genuinely surprised by some of the things. Because, like, I see a morph, and a guy attacks it, and he's got 5 mana up, and I've got a removal spell. And, you know, like, I'm expecting him to go to flip. And so he, you know, he asked me, do I have an effect before damage? And that, you know, that means he's passing to me. So he's willing to trade the morph, and my morph was really good, so I didn't want to trade it. So I spent a removal spell. I spent, what was it? I think, where is it? Kill shot. Yeah, I just kill shot. Cause like all the morphs I had seen all day were like, pay 5 mana, flip into something huge. So I'm like, I'm going to kill shot this eventually. Like, let me keep my morph, untap into 5 mana, crack back in and flip. I think Abzant Guide is what I wanted to flip. Just like get ahead on life, have a 4/4 life link in play, like totally force the tempo to go in my favor. Well, he didn't pay 5 mana to flip his morph. He paid like 3 or whatever and flipped over the hexproof guy. So it not only ate my removal spell, it then also killed my really good morph. And it was just one of those things where it's like, wow, I had totally forgotten there is this, you know, it's the morph when it flips up, it gives target creature hexproof. It was just like one of those things where it's like, wow, like I expected just to destroy some stupid fatty I wanted to get out of my way anyway. And instead, like, it was just total blowout, even from a morph that didn't have 5 mana to throw up. And so it was just, it felt really bad because I went on to lose the game because, like, oops, I lost 2 of the best cards in my opening hand. But it was genuine surprise. Like, it felt really good to have, like that's a thing that can happen now, and I know that's a thing, and every time I see a morph and there's, like, 4 mana up with blue mana, it's like, well, do I cast something like a kill spell or a bounce spell on this thing, or, you know, like it's just gonna make me pause. It's like that Willbender effect in Commander.
Yeah.
You know, so
The guys that flip for free are kind of cool in that regard too.
Oh yeah, the Death Touched guy.
Yeah, the Death Touched guy is my favorite one because, like, you're happy to run him out on turn one, or later on, obviously. Now you get in some extra beats, and then he's going to morph and deal some damage. Kind of nice.
Yeah, I had one take out my Ivory Tusk Fortress, which is like a 5/7 for 5. So people just looked at it and they're like, that's not fair for 5 mana. but it has no evasion, and its ability doesn't even help itself most of the time. It's untap each creature you control with a +1/+1 counter on it during each other player's untap step, which seems really cool, because when I saw that card, originally, I was like, oh, wow, that must mean, like there's an effect that makes you outlast any time, and there isn't. It's just like, okay, cool, my outlast guy's untap, and sit there. Awesome. The black morph guy totally got my Ivory Tusk.
Yeah, I actually had one of each of the morph creatures in black, white, green, and in one turn, I had all 3 in play and flipped them all with the same card in my hand. It's pretty sweet. I had the guide in my hand, which was kind of sucky because I then didn't morph him, I just cast him, but whatever. But yeah, I unmorphed all 3 of the guys in one turn with the guide. And I don't think it was correct to unmorph the third. The first 2 is definitely correct. Like, one of my guys, like, 3-1 traded with something, and I don't know what happened to the other ones. But then I was like, this is too sweet to not do, and I, like, gained my 2 life at the end of the turn or whatever, and then flipped the bird over just because I had to at that point. But it was pretty funny.
So another card that really struck me as really punching above its pay grade, or hitting above its... Yeah, whatever the expression is, playing above its pay grade, whatever, is the 4/2 common bear, that basically the teamer bear that gives you ferocious for 3 mana. That bear, like, I, you know, when I first saw it, I was like, okay, cool, it'll just, I'll just trade it with this morph, you know, my derpiest morph that I have out. And that bear just coming down on turn 3 and then turning on all of the bonuses on teamer tricks, like things like the savage, you know, the bear punch spell, savage punch, and icy grip, whatever the one where there's where you get the loot and tap down a guy, like just all of their tricks just got really good, and it's not something like you you know, it felt very weird. Like you kind of all, you know, you expect, okay, the Mardu deck's going to make a bunch of dudes, and it's going to come at me quick, and it's raid, and it's attacking, okay. But the teamer deck, like, as soon as all of their tricks are online with Ferocious, their tricks are just hands and, like a head span above almost all of the other tricks in the that I've seen. You know,
yeah, the same thing's true about the, there's another 3-mana 4 power guy, which is the red one. He's 3-mana 4/4, and when he attacks a box, he sacrifices mana in a combat. That guy does a very similar thing, and he's super scary too, because he'll sit there and defend you, and your opponent won't attack anything, so it'll buy you time, and then you're going to start rattling off these ferocious spells.
Yeah, I'm looking at my sideboard now from the pre-release. I opened and emptied the pits, and I was not able to jam it in my deck. I just did not have enough black to do it. I know. Everybody laughed at me, and then they didn't laugh when I said there was no game in which I had 4 black mana available.
You didn't play Force.
Every single game.
You didn't play Force Monster deck.
No, I had.
You didn't have four black sources in your deck.
No, I did. I had enough. I never had 4.
But you had 4 in your deck, so you had enough to play it, is all I'm saying.
Even the game against the Obzon, where we went to like 10 cards left in our deck, I still never had 4 black mana available.
Well, you must have misplayed that game or something.
I'm 100% sure I did. I'm sure.
All I'm saying is, if I haven't emptied the pits and I have at least 4 black sources in my deck, it's going in. That card is absurd.
One card I should have experimented with, but I didn't, and I think would have done a lot of work. Kin Tree Invocation. It's a green black sorcery, and it puts an XX black and green Spirit Warrior token onto the battlefield, where X is the greatest toughness among creatures you control. Consistently, my toughness was like 4, 5, or 6. So getting to make a 4/4 for 2 mana, or even a 3/3, you know, isn't terrible. But I would have consistently had some huge fatty for just 2 mana.
Yeah, I had the wall. He like makes people lose life. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like a 0/5 or something like that. 2.
Yeah.
I don't know. I had him. It was my only like big toughness thing. But I did get the combo off with the invocation on that. But otherwise, I was casting it pretty late and getting some decent sized things. But yeah, I'm gonna look up that guy's name real quick. You talk.
one other trick that really stood out to me as doing a lot in different kinds of decks is that's the thing that I was looking for, is like, what are the tricks that, yeah, there's an obvious clan or kind of obvious deck it goes into, but what are the non-obvious things that come up with it? And Dragon Scale Boon just blew me away. And by that I mean it consistently blew me out, because I just attacked into it, you know, like I couldn't save my life for
that's
it.
That's the first strike one?
No, it's 3 and a green for an instant, put 2+1/+1 counters on target creature and untap it. Just the random, like, oops, now there's +1/+1 counters on this dude, and by the way, I've got a falconer, so it's flying, so it's eating your 3/3 flyer out of nowhere. Getting to put 2+1/+1 counters on a morph that's attacking, like at 5 mana, like this happened on turn 4. So I'm going second. Opponent's turn 4, he plays a land, tacks into my morph. If I'm just like snap block, like I get rid of this guy, like I don't care. And he Dragon Scale Boons it. So he untaps, wins that next turn, attacks in with a 4/4, threatening with 5 mana to untap it. And it's like, I can't block a 4/4. And if I, you know, he can just not unmorph it. Like, if I cast some sort of trick, like, okay, great, he's out of card, but like he didn't have to spend the mana on morph it to continue the putting pressure on. Just little things like that, just really drew my attention to Dragon Scale Boon. Like, by the end of the day, I was seriously considering trying to figure out if I could put a third green card in my deck, just because I wanted to play Dragon Scale Boon.
That's fair. Archer's Parapet is the card I was thinking of. Colorless and Green, 0/5 Defender. Colorless and Black, tap. Target player loses, or no, each opponent, sorry, loses 1 life. So I comboed that up and got a turn 3/5/5, which is pretty nice. And I believe, is the invocation common or uncommon?
Dragonscale Boon, or?
No, the invocation, the black green make a XX.
That's an uncommon. Yeah.
Okay. Because the parapet's common, so you can look for that guy.
The only multicolored commons in the set are the cycle of the five wedge morphs. Every other gold card is uncommon or higher.
Sure. Regarding the dragon scale thing, what's it called? Dragonscale Boon. I thought you were talking about a different card, which is also surprised me how strong it was. The +2/+0 first strike and flash of its ferocious spell. That card will surprise the heck out of you sometimes. I could just tell you that. Like, the ferocious part...
Dragon Grip,
yes, that's what I thought you were talking about. The ferocious part is like, you know, oh, okay, I'll see that coming because they have a 4 power guy in play, but like, the card, it's not, I don't think it'll be super heavily played, so when it does show up, it's like very difficult to play around, and +2/+0 in first strike on something that already has 4 power is like so difficult to deal with, and that card just, it was surprisingly strong. I thought it was going to be nearly unplayable because most Auras are, but it was actually quite good. I don't think you should play like a million of it or anything like that, but it is, it's kind of a nice one to have in your back pocket.
Yeah, that was one of the cards on top of my as like one of my potential sideboard cards. The problem, like, my deck, like, basically it was like I had a ton of guys with 3 power and then like a handful with more, like one morph guy, my Ivory Tusk Fortress, so for me, I it was rare that I had like 4 power. Which is really frustrating because, like, flash first strike is just good. For some reason, like, I kept looking at Defiant Strike because I thought it was +1/+0 and first strike until end of turn. It's just +1/+0, so it's like
it's
nigh unplayable. So it's nigh unplayable.
No, 1 mana cantrip's always fine.
One card that I should have put back in my deck that some of the better players convinced me I shouldn't was Act of Treason. With so many huge fatties running around.
And sacrifice effects.
Like I found myself in situations where I was like in a really tight race. Like even against decks where I felt like I was always like a step behind. It felt like I was always like a creature of damage within reach. And it was always like a differential of like 3 or 4. And so like these situations were like, you know, left back like one really good blocker and you know, like some dirtle guy, and they're tapped out or tapped too low on mana to really unmorph anything scary. There are plenty of situations where like being able to Act of Treason, like their stupid big flying guy or just a fatty with trample, all the teamer decks and their stupid trample guys. I think the value of a random Act of Treason is going to be really good for aggressive decks that want it.
Sure. Well, that was my pre-release. I got nothing more.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting a draft in. Looks like might happen later this week.
Yeah, we're doing some tomorrow. Pretty excited, and Thursday I think, back to back draftos. And then we have the Human Centipede 4 review for you. Go ahead, Adam.
Human Centipede 4 is a horror noir kind of dystopian future movie where you have a visionary director implementing this really surrealistic look into what happens when humans need to, in order to survive, need to be surgically merged into one being.
Yeah. It's classic. You find Bigfoot, and then they put that onto a person, and then because they use the top half of Bigfoot, it actually is ironic because then Bigfoot has little feet. But it gets very deep. It's very a lot of metaphors. It'll make you think. It'll make you reevaluate your life. And it's recommended by Tom, so go check it out.
Absolutely.
That's all I got. I had to get in there for Tom, you know.
So aside from the pre-release, so aside from the cards and all of that, so I don't know how big you are on this stuff.
I'm big in general as like a 6'5", 300-pound man. But
I mean, we've hugged before. We have a healthy appreciation for the gravitational attraction we each generate.
Sure.
But the one thing that I'm really digging about pre-releases, and they seem to be evolving and kind of getting better over time, is the kind of like the random swag that comes with the pre-release is awesome. So at PAX Prime, I went to the PAX party, and yay, it was a ton of fun. It's like everything. It's like, you know, it's like magical. It's like magical. It's like Disneyland for magic. Like, it's just what going to that party's like. And I was able to buy an So I had an Obzon shirt to wear the pre-release, and worked out for gunslinging, get my Obzon deck, wear my shirt, blah, blah, blah. But one of the guys didn't want his pin, so I said, hey, I'll take your pin. So I had two Obzon pins. And I noticed everybody got a clan pin. And so, like, these little things were, like, you know, like a year ago, I remember it was like, okay, well, or 2 years ago, it was like, okay, we're turning around and we get, like, these little stickers that kind of fall off stuff right away. And then, and then a year ago, we didn't get anything, and this year we got, like, pins, which feel like, you know, the quality of the pin was, like, better than, like, the free Gen Con pin I got it from, like, Gen Con itself. So these are nice pins, and it's, like, the ability where if you're really passionate about Magic, you know, and we are, because we're recording a podcast about this, but for the new players, I played against several players that have been playing for, like, they came back with Magic 2015, they've been away for, like, you know, 10 years or 15 years, or they've only been playing for 3 weeks, and their friend kind of got them hooked, and, you know, it's just, like, literally like their first time, but, like, once you're invested, like, being able to show off, like, hey, I've got this cool pin, or, like, hey, I've got this really neat way of expressing myself that isn't necessarily a magical card, like, it's something, like, everybody loves pins. You know, like, everybody kind of gets, like, what that's for. I just feel like they're getting much better about giving us things to share the game beyond the game. Like, they want to sell Magic as kind of like a lifestyle, or kind of like a hobby lifestyle kind of thing. And now one of your first play experiences, like, lets you do that. I just felt really good. Like, I thought the pre-release kits were very well done this time.
I'm all for it.
How did it feel with, well, I don't know how much you pre-release. So pre-release is, like, the highlight of, like, that's the most competitive thing I'll do in any given, well, coverage drafts, I guess, are kind of competitive, but, like, officially, on the record, you know, when I register for events, it's, like, my Planeswalker points are, like, primarily pre-releases these days. Like, the fact that the promos were just, like, basically, like, a random one within your clan, more or less.
Yeah, like, I like that a lot.
Yeah, like I didn't feel like some people felt like they got punished because, like, they got unlucky, and it's like, that's, you know, of course a very Magic curmudgeon player way to look at it, like, oh, somebody else got something slightly better than you, boohoo on me. But I felt like it felt good not to play against the same rare. Like, somebody sits down and they put down, like, their first two lands, and it's like, you kind of know, okay, well, they've got a demon in their deck, or oh, they probably have that stupid angel that gains them back up to 20 in their deck.
Yeah.
Like not having that hanging over my head, like, felt really good.
Definitely agree. I think that, it was kind of nice. That was much better executed than any previous pre-release. I like that what's been going on in terms of them paying attention, listening, and responding and improving. Obviously, there's some areas like Magic Online that we've not gotten to the point where there's satisfaction yet, but overall I feel like the interaction between the player base and WotC has grown quite strong and reliable over the last couple of years, and it seems pretty healthy.
Yeah, I'm a little worried what's going to happen, because I know that the pre-release kits were Dave Guskin's baby. That's something he was focusing on more or less as, like, you know, a primary piece of his job. Dave Guskin, for those of you who aren't aware, was a member of R&D, and he was an experienced designer. You know, it was basically one of the, you know, what he switched over to was basically design, like, getting feedback from and helping to design pre-releases. And so he left Wizards earlier this year to move across the country. And, you know, I think for a variety of reasons, just, you know, needed a change and needed to move. And he now works on games out here on the East Coast, I think out of near Massachusetts. But I know that the pre-release kits were something he really took seriously and, you know, put a lot of thought into, and they were things that he really wanted to make sure were really polished, phenomenal experience for players. So, yeah, I'm really hoping that all of the things that Dave had helped discover and learn and lay down kind of continues on, even if it's some, you know, a different team or somebody else kind of really heading up.
Definitely. Agree. Concur.
So, all right. So, I think you might have a strong opinion on this, Conley.
I don't have strong opinions on many things.
I know. So this is something that actually just kind of came up this week. This is kind of as breaking news as MTG Potpourri will do. And I know you've had to have seen it, Conley. Like it was all over social media, like today and yesterday. So somebody, a Magic Online, they post a selection of decks that are successful in events. So they don't post all of them. And we'll get into the discussion of whether that's good or bad in of itself. And, you know, there is a data issue there underlying why they don't post every deck list from all of the events. But one of the deck lists that went 4-0 in Standard was basically a deck designed to exploit a bug. This is the Spine Sire bug. The Spine Sire bug. So Spine Sire, you know, a card you haven't heard us mention yet. It's been around a while. I believe it's a Born of the Gods card.
It's Born of the Gods. Or no, it's it was when they showed off Bestow, but like anti-Bestow. So yeah.
Oh, if it's anti-Bestow, that's Journey into Nyx.
Okay, because it's in the same cycle as, like, the must-attack guy, can't-block guy, all that crap.
Okay, so it's Journey into Nyx. So sure. It's a card that's been out for, you know, let's say
6 months.
6 month-ish. And so basically it works like this. So you Spine Sire one of your opponent's creatures, and when you attack, you Spine Sire one of your opponent's tapped creatures, and when you attack... Magic Online won't let you not block. So Spine Sire says you have to block. And basically there's this, you know, it's this bug that even though the creature Spine Sire is bestowed upon can't legally block, Magic Online won't let you skip it. You know, basically it just has this like soft loop where like it's trying to make you block Spine Sire, but you can't. So basically the deck is built to have a hexproof creature that you're attacking with, so basically effectively can't be removed or targeted or bounced, or, you know, you can't get out of this combat loop, and you have Spine Sire on an opponent's creature. I think that's how it works, because I'm going by memory here.
I'll trust you here, because I have no idea.
But that's effectively the gist of it, it's this setup of cards designed to exploit what Magic, you know, a bug on Magic Online. So the deck went 4-0 in a standard daily event. What are your thoughts on that, Conley?
I personally would never do that. I would find it shady and it would make me feel dirty. However, sure. He is exploiting something that WotC has basically been too lazy to fix. So while I 100% disagree with not fixing the bug approximately previous to 6 months ago, the fact that it still exists to this day and WotC has not said Spine is illegal in Standard as they should have on Magic Online, they should have just said that, or they should have said just illegal to play this card or whatever, or anything of that nature, instead of doing that, they allowed him to play with it. They allowed him to take away the fun of a bunch of his opponents who were probably very frustrated by this. And then they not only allowed this, but shined a light onto it, to where a whole bunch of other people now are going to build decks to exploit this bug. And they didn't immediately say, all right, Spire Side is banned or anything like that. So the bug's still being worked on, and there's a bunch of people that are abusing a bug on Magic Online, partially because WotC showcased it. So I am not a fan with how they handle any of this, and I'm not a fan with how they handle bugs, and I'm not a fan of Magic Online in general, and so this has not helped. I don't like to share my real opinion, though, remember.
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much said everything, you know, all more or less my thoughts on it. You know, I mean, I think that I'm almost 100% sure that somewhere in the terms of service that if you're exploiting a known bug, whether it's acknowledged or fixed or something that should have been addressable, you know, by Wizards, and clearly I believe this is something that should have been addressable. It's not like this was like a surprise. This bug's in there. You know, it's been identified earlier. But I mean, pretty clearly, like in the terms of service, you know, if you're exploiting something, you know, the terms of service cover that's a no-no. You're not allowed to intentionally exploit. Like we can kick you out and keep all your money for that. You know, that's pretty typical in like MMOs. Like I know that's been a very classical thing that's happened with World of Warcraft, for example, is they'll discover a bug. You know, these teams that are trying to get the world first on something in the game will find some sort of bug, and some of them over time to time have exploited it, whether intentionally or unintentionally, and they've taken consequences for that. So whether you want to blame Wizards or you want to blame the guy for kind of being like a jerk about it, or the girl for being a jerk about it, you know, it's Magic Online, we don't know who it is. I think this is just kind of like one of those things where if, you know, I have a lot of hope for Magic Online. Like, I am looking forward to leagues. I am looking forward to the opportunity to really play more limited in a way that suits me. Like, I want to be able to just play a game and then go away. Like, I don't want to commit 5 hours to, or 4 hours to getting a draft in.
Let me tell you about this great little game being worked on in Denver.
it's a modern design tool. I mean, Hearthstone has that, Soulforge has that. Like there are a lot of games that I've tried that have that feature that I appreciate. So I'm looking forward to when there's, you know, a comparable type of feature on Magic Online, because I love Sealed way too much to ignore leagues. Like, I just want to do it, but to hold out and defend kind of the way Magic Online is being managed. I've hit a point where I'm really tenuous about it myself. Like I love that I can play Magic anytime. I love that I can load up a commander deck. I love that would I want to, I could have, I elected to pass on having a God account for a variety of reasons. So like I could have like an account for Command Tower and build like any commander deck with any cards that I want on Magic Online and test it out. Like those are features I definitely appreciate and really have a healthy amount of respect for. But it's just really frustrating that I know this Friday when I go to have a conversation and somebody asks me like, hey, you know, are you going to play Commander Online? You know, and somebody makes a wisecrack about, a standard deck that's basically built on a bug in the software, you know, that's been known for at least weeks before the event in which it was exploited took place. You know, it's just really disheartening. Like I just really, you know, it's not even that there's a bug in there that can be exploited, because that's just how digital games work. Like, that's always going to be a thing. Like, somebody will always find a corner case. Like, there is no perfectly bug-free game. Like, even Hearthstone has had bugs and had issues with that.
When League of Legends has a bug, they say this champion is disabled for this amount of time, or we're not allowing it in ranked play, or we'll get it fixed within the hour. Like, it's that's the problem.
And that's where it's just like I'm beginning to fall apart, because I've come to expect that type of response, where even if it's something that's really difficult to fix, and I've seen this with, like, for example, Diablo 3. Like, I've really gotten into Diablo 3. I've enjoyed playing seasonal. I've enjoyed, you know, kind of chasing loot and trying new builds. And
yeah, new non-auction house Diablo is quite good.
Yeah, it's amazing. It is everything I wanted from the original game. I mean, it literally is. If you haven't played Diablo 3, or you bought it and you were like, wow, this game is a pile.
It sucked before. I'm right with you, everybody. I totally understand if you think we're talking up the game. It was a terrible game with the auction house, but they did quite a good job turning it around into the non-auction house form. And if you enjoy Diablo, it's pretty consistent with the fun that Diablo 2 was, for whatever it's worth.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I put it above Diablo 2 for fun. I mean, just the variety of builds that you can do, and the way that you have, you know, high-speed, engaging gameplay. It really delivers. So that's my experience. It's even when they have difficulty fixing something, they do their very best to either remove its impact, push content patches. They're quick to at least minimize its impact on the active player base.
They just canceled a 7-year project that they've been working on, Titan, their MMO.
Well, that's a Blizzard thing, though.
I know, but I'm just saying that, these video game companies that take pride in their work, they're, like, you know, they want, like, that thing is, Rocky doesn't consider himself a video game company. They consider himself, you know, a card game company or whatever, a fantasy company. I don't know what the next thing is, to be honest. But they don't, for some reason, Magic Online is the afterthought. And if they were treating it like the main thing, like Blizzard, like any of the big companies, for that matter, even like the console game companies, if they just treated their games, their Magic Online as their brand, kind of the way they do with duels with Planeswalkers, then, you know, I think it would just be an awesome product. But it's, for some reason, it is not quite caught up yet.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's my mini rant, for an episode where it's two people that typically have divergent opinions about a lot of things, like, I don't know whether they're good or awful that we've agreed on, like, half of, like, almost
the whole episode. Oh, I was just lying almost the whole episode just to make you happy.
Wow. That makes me feel much better. Thank you. Thank you for lying to me. So, without Tom to do some sort of wild tangent on the end, you know, I think we'll just wrap it at a pretty clean, you know, close to a neat hour of content.
You want to throw out your Twitter handles?
Of course. I'm Adam Staworski, the_Stibbs on Twitter, content manager for Gathering Magic, writer for Daily MTG, Command Tower, coverage reporter at Grand Prix and Pro Tours. You can reach me at stibbs@gatheringmagic.com or, again, Twitter, the_Stibbs.
You only can reach me on Twitter. Now, you can actually maybe reach me on Facebook if you're lucky and you're already one of my friends, but I'm kind of capped on space there. You can reach me on Twitter, at Conley81, 81 are the numericals there. I write for channelfireball.com, tcgplayer.com, videos for channelfireball.com, and you'll see me on stream occasionally too. Twitch channel is Conley81 as well. Thanks for listening.
And if you want to yell at Tom for missing out and having to save puppies and kittens all night, you can hit him, PSG Reader, on Twitter. That's PSG Reader, all one word. And it's our lovely email address, mtgpotpourri@gatheringmagic.com. mtgpotpourri@gatheringmagic.com. On Twitter, mtgpotpourri. All of that will work to get a hold of Tom, because he loves to hear from you.
He mostly loves to hear the words MTG Potpourri muttered by somebody.
Oh, yes. So, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Awesome.